Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Wednesday, July 6th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Looking back to think forward on the Iraq War.
Take the fact that he develops weapons of mass destruction very seriously.
The United States knows that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. The UK knows they have weapons of mass destruction.
Which could be activated within 45 minutes, including against his own Shia population.
I apologize for the fact that the intelligence we received was wrong.
Those weapons of mass destruction got to be somewhere.
Despite explicit warnings, the consequences of the invasion were underestimated. The planning and preparations for Iraq after Saddam Hussein were wholly inadequate. We have concluded that the UK chose to join the invasion of Iraq before the peaceful options for disarmament had been exhausted.
Listening there to Contradictions and Consternation, 7 years, $14 million, and 2.6 million words later, Britain's Iraq Inquiry Committee has finally produced a report that gets to the heart of intelligence failures, the weapons of mass destruction that weren't there, and the use of that intelligence to drive much of the war in Iraq. The Chilcot Report, it's so named for John Chilcot, a retired civil servant tasked to oversee that commission, is about 6 years overdue after British Prime Minister Tony Blair stepped down in 2009. Blair's successor, Gordon Brown, set up the inquiry in 2009 to fully examine Britain's involvement in the Iraq War over the course of 12 months. At one point, Iraq war victims went so far as to threaten to sue over the report's release. John Chilcot said today that Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein posed no imminent threat when the U.S.-led invasion was launched in March of 2003, and that while military action against him, quote, might have been necessary at some point, the strategy of containment could have continued for some time. Chilcot said that former British Prime Minister Tony Blair was warned of the risks of regional instability and the rise of terrorism before the invasion of Iraq, but pressed on regardless. And the UK failed to appreciate the complexity of governing Iraq and did not devote enough forces to the task of securing the country in the wake of the invasion, he added. The people of Iraq have suffered greatly, Chilcot said. But this assessment bears directly also on the suffering of veterans, the UK soldiers who fought in Iraq, and US troops.
We need to accept that war is not the solution to the problems the world faces in the 21st century. We need to come up with other ways of sorting out our problems.
That's Ben Griffin, founder of Veterans for Peace UK. He served with the British Special Forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. He attended a rally with fellow veterans today after the Chilcot report found that the invasion of Iraq was based on flawed intelligence and assessments that went unchallenged. The U.S. has never had an official investigation into the legality of the Iraq War, much less into the torture of prisoners at Abu Ghraib prison or elsewhere, although 11 soldiers were convicted of related crimes in a military tribunal. More than a decade after U.S. troops landed in Iraq, do we have a national consensus on the war, its reasons, its motivation? Was it, as presidential candidate Bernie Sanders called it, the worst foreign policy in U.S. history? Is this undeclared war, is there a case to be made by U.S. soldiers in the same way the U.K. is looking at the invasion of Iraq, as an instance of something we might call political fraud? Christopher Goldsmith served as a sergeant with the Army's 3rd Infantry Division from 2004 to 2007.
You know, I think that what this report that's being released today means to a lot of people who served in Iraq, not just Americans, but across the allied countries, is that we're finally getting a responsible view of what we were actually involved in. You know, for me, when I enlisted in the Army, I signed my contract at the end of 2004, and at that time, most people still believed that Saddam Hussein had an active weapons program, that he was actively seeking nuclear weapons capabilities.
And people believed that because that was the government's message.
Exactly. You know, but they also falsely believed, which the government never said explicitly, that Saddam Hussein had some involvement in September 11th. And being a New Yorker, you know, being 16 years old and able to see the smoke of the smoldering towers from my hometown, you know, that's one of those things why, that's one of the reasons why I didn't hesitate to enlist in a combat MOS and fight in Iraq.
So what would it mean if, you know, Bush's excuse was, George Tenet said it was a Hail Mary on the intelligence that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. And his response to the U.S. government was basically, well, you know, we believed it at the time. This Chilicot report seems to suggest that, no, that's not enough, or maybe you didn't believe that at the time, and that means we sent our soldiers into battle for, you know, fraudulent reasons, essentially. What does that mean to you, and what can you do about it?
You know, I personally am not going to do anything about it. I wouldn't want to reopen those old wounds, you know, beyond simply just, you know, processing it. But I think that, you know, part of democracy is people being held responsible for their decisions as leaders.
Well, if you don't do anything, there's no accountability.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, we're living in a political era with you know, everyone's obsessed with emails right now, and everyone's obsessed with the four Americans that we tragically lost in Benghazi. You know, and for me, as someone who served in Iraq, I can't help but feel like I was forgotten, and that my brothers, the sacrifice of my brothers and sisters in Iraq, were forgotten. You know, there was literally more than 1,000 times more American deaths in Iraq. The decisions that led us to invade that country should be closely analyzed. I would love to see our Congress, you know, do a similar investigation. Now, as far as you know, what people need to recognize is that this isn't an indictment. It's the British government, in a nonpartisan way, has examined history, and the lessons of history are important. You know, I, as a veterans advocate, you know, want to make sure that our military is used in a responsible way, because I've seen the human cost, not just on the American side, but on the side of you know, those that we are supposedly liberating. I've seen the suffering firsthand. You know, this weekend, there were well over 100 deaths in Baghdad, and it's hard to separate our invasion from those deaths. You know,
you're in Iraqi, there is no separation.
Exactly.
So getting back to the issue of, you have struggled with PTSD. There are comrades of yours in arms who have lost arms and legs, who are sitting wondering, you know, is there a civil issue at least to be pushed, not for damages or to, you know, allow you to be rich, but at least to force the government to be held accountable to the question of, all right, you didn't declare a war. You said there was X, Y, and Z in Iraq. You said there was this sort of involvement with terrorism. You know, somebody's going to have to answer for that. There's a British soldier who may take that case. If one does, do you think an American soldier should do it?
You know, I think that out of the millions of Americans who've served in Iraq, I think that there's bound to be a handful who would want to move forward with that type of thing. I mean, I just found out that a friend of mine, who kind of disappeared off of Facebook a few weeks ago, is in inpatient treatment, and he's one of those folks who lost a hand, who you know, really was blown to bits. I didn't find out that he was in inpatient treatment until just yesterday, after a suicide attempt. And you know, this is the type of thing that's become the new normal for many Iraq veterans. And you know, I do think that someone needs to be held accountable, and if it's you know,
I understand, Christopher, I understand you're not going to do it, and I don't want to open wounds with you. But I think in the abstract, because you say this is an issue of democracy, and I grant you that, if you were in the courtroom and Donald Rumsfeld was on the stand, what would you ask him as a witness?
You know, I would ask him to it's a complicated one. I have a hard time right now feeling like the folks who are responsible for having led us to war truly have appreciated the suffering that they have caused the American service members and the sacred trust that I feel is betrayed. You know, what I would love to see is someone like Donald Rumsfeld advocating for increases to the VA, budgeting. It's, as a veterans advocate right now, I face members of Congress who are concerned about cost. And it's so infuriating to me that paying for the damages to the physical and mental being of those who enlisted in a time of war is something that Congress is concerned with the cost, whereas the invasion is something that everyone seemed to be okay with just jumping to conclusions and not being concerned with the outcome.
And everyone in America is complicit with that, I think, because I think everyone in America went with the government's assessment here. There were some people who voted against the war, mm-hmm. but I think the consensus was at the time that this was something that the American military needed to do, and it had the support of the American people, and it had the support of Congress. Do you think we are moving in America towards an opposite consensus, that now, so long after 9/11 and so long after the invasion in 2003, that people, and we've heard some of the rhetoric in the campaign, that people are much more likely to say this war was a mistake?
Yeah, I think that people have recognized that the war started under false pretenses and it was a mistake. And what's, like I said before, what's infuriating to me is that now taking care of veterans is a cost issue. I keep hearing that. I've always heard that slogan, freedom isn't free. You know, people love to talk about freedom isn't free. And what they tend to mean when they say that is, oh, well, we've paid in blood for our freedom. But, I say freedom isn't free, then pay your damn taxes. You know, you shouldn't be upset about a tax raise when you allowed our soldiers, our Marines, our airmen, our sailors to go into war for over a decade, and then not get the most premier care at the VA when they come home. You know, I think that Americans have a responsibility to make sure that we do everything that we can to heal the wounds of war. And part of that is, I think, doing an investigation similar to Britain's, to really take an introspective look and say, how did we get here, and what do we do to prevent this type of mistake in the future?
Christopher Goldsmith is a sergeant who served in the Army's 3rd Infantry Division in Iraq. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
The World Health Organization, the WHO, launched an emergency yellow fever vaccination campaign in the East African countries of Angola and the Democratic Republic of Congo over the weekend after an outbreak of the viral hemorrhagic disease yellow fever. It sickened thousands and killed upwards of 400 people so far this year. The outbreak has revealed a worldwide shortage of the yellow fever vaccine. A 5-to-1 diluted dose protocol to deal with the shortage provides protection from yellow fever for 12 months versus a full dose, which lasts a lifetime. There is no cure for yellow fever. Dr. William Moss is professor of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and head of epidemiology at the International Vaccine Access Center. Dr. Moss, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So what is yellow fever? How does it differ from malaria? And again, mosquitoes are the culprit. What can we do to control it?
As you suggested, yellow fever is caused by a virus, yellow fever virus, whereas malaria is caused by a parasite, Plasmodium. And in fact, the mosquitoes that transmit both of these diseases are quite different. Yellow fever is transmitted by a mosquito called Aedes aegypti, the same mosquito that's received a lot of attention recently. It transmits Zika virus as well as dengue and chikungunya. whereas malaria is transmitted by female Anopheles mosquitoes. But fortunately for yellow fever, we have a highly effective vaccine that was developed back in the 1930s. It's what we call an attenuated viral vaccine. These vaccines have different concentrations of the attenuated virus within them, really provide lifetime protection. And there's fairly good evidence that by diluting and decreasing the amount of virus, you can at least provide short-term protection. The problem, as you know, with the recent outbreak has been a shortage of the vaccine.
I guess, you know, I'm not a doctor, but we've got numbers that could rise very, very quickly. The numbers of available vaccine are low and the dilution is short-term. I mean, we could be facing this exactly again in a year.
It is a tricky situation where you can't really predict what the next outbreak is going to be, how large it is. You can prepare for worst case scenarios, but that can be expensive. We need to certainly do better as a public health community. I think we could have larger stocks of yellow fever vaccine. We can try to anticipate these outbreaks. This could have been anticipated, but Angola hadn't had a yellow fever outbreak in several decades.
And some people think of the Earth as an organism in and of itself. The stockpiles of vaccines are a kind of an immune system. If anyone's seen anyone die of hemorrhagic disease, like yellow fever or some of the other closely related diseases, I mean, it just seems like cost should be no object here.
Right, but it is obviously in trying to garner the resources to manufacture these vaccines. Yellow fever vaccine, it's not a big profit maker for the vaccine manufacturers. The populations often affected by yellow fever, these outbreaks, as we've seen recently, are relatively poor countries. It's not going to be profit making. So we do need mechanisms to be able to finance and provide vaccines. Now, organizations such as UNICEF and Gavi and the World Health Organization try to garner the resources from the richer countries in order to provide vaccines to poor countries and prevent such outbreaks. There are many countries in West Africa, for example, that routinely provide yellow fever vaccine to their children and try to achieve a level of immunity in the population. I think we've seen some breakdown in the system. People have been able to travel from Angola to other countries. I know there's been particular concern about China, where yellow fever virus could be introduced into areas where it previously had not been.
Dr. William Moss is professor of epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and he's head of epidemiology at the International Vaccine Access Center. Dr. Moss, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
One of the key technological questions in this century of hyperconnectedness is, who do you call in an emergency? How do you call them? For some people, texting has become their sole means of electronic communication. And during the recent Orlando shooting, some people who were held hostage in the club were afraid that calling 911 would draw the attention of the attacker. But there was no text option in Orlando, like the vast majority of U.S. cities. Orlando does not have 911 texting. So hostages were forced to text loved ones, asking them to call 911 on their behalf. Only a tenth of the nation's 6,000 911 dispatch centers can accept text messages of any kind. Another 150 dispatch centers are upgrading, but that could flood the system with more false or misleading reporting and other problems. Joseph Giacalone is a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and a retired New York City police sergeant. Joseph, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm great. And how much of an upgrade do you think the 911 system needs based on all the different ways you could reach out in an emergency?
Well, I mean, I think it needs a big overhaul. The infrastructure here, especially like in New York City, is rather old, and this text messages has come into play in different forms and varieties. We need to have a new infrastructure put in, so it could be rather expensive to do so.
And when we're talking about the Orlando shooting, when there were so many texts of people desperately trying to get messages out, there was no place necessarily for those messages to go. But there's also the issue of flooding an emergency notification center with the messages that confuse first responders.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the things that they have to put into the infrastructure when they're building this out. And just like our highways, right? When, you know, three lanes on the LIE, if they would have only had a little foresight, they would have been able to build five, six lanes. So this is what they need to do now so that they can avoid that problem in the future.
What is this going to take nationally?
Well, it's going to take a lot of money. It's going to take the federal government to have to get involved in this in order to provide grants for departments, especially smaller ones. Because if you're waiting for police departments to spend the money on this, we're in big trouble because they don't have any money. And, you know, the jurisdictions are going to have to come up with it. And it's as simple as that. And we'll probably end up paying another tax for it, you know, a 911 tax on your cell phone or what have you. But you know what? In the long run, it'll be worth it.
And who's responsible for setting up 911 systems in various jurisdictions?
Well, and that's it. Every jurisdiction, there's over 18,000 different police departments in this country. Each one has its own budget. So we're going to have to figure out who is going to be paying for this. And it's usually the local government that's involved in this. And that's the problem, because we know after a financial crisis in 2007, there's not a lot of money to be thrown around for different kinds of projects.
So a call to a police officer for a crime and a call for, you know, emergency, I my baby fell into the water or something like that, they go to the same place?
Yes, and this is, you know, you're going to have to hire new people in order to take text messages, and you're going to have the people to answer telephones, because you can't have somebody do both. So this is another expense that police departments are going to have to, you know, put into play. Like I said, it's a good thing, but, you know, we have to think it well through.
It sounds like a big design issue in the sense that you're going to want to, you know which place to go to first. Is there any indication from the Orlando shooting that messengers from using their cell phones and texting were able to get information more quickly than people dialing 911 or other methods?
No, there isn't any, you know, evidence of that just yet. You know, the investigation isn't even over yet. But I think police departments were relying on social media to be like the panacea for this. Like you could send things through Twitter, but then they have Twitter accounts that aren't manned 24 hours a day. So it's something that, you know, we have to start looking at this as a real problem solver.
What motivated the 911 system to begin with?
Well, like everything else, as the telephone and everything was created during the, you know, the times. I mean, this is a way to communicate with the police department. I mean, when you think about it, 50 years ago, even New York City police officers didn't even have radios in the, you know, on their person. They might have had one in the car if they were lucky, or they had to go to a call box. So as technology has changed, and now text messaging and social media, so will the way we contact law enforcement. It just takes a little time because of the fact that, the you know, a lot of money is involved in order to upgrade this stuff.
What's the fastest way to get the information from a complicated crime scene to a first responder? Is it voice? Is it text? What do you think?
Well, I would prefer the voice because of the fact that as a former investigator, I can ask certain questions that the caller might not really have deemed important at the time. So from a law enforcement perspective, we'd like to talk to you. But we understand that there's a need for a text messages in a critical situation like an active shooter, though. So these are the things that have to be worked out.
Joe Jacalone is a criminal justice professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice and a retired police sergeant. He spoke to us from Long Island. Thanks so much, Joe.
Take care, John.
The famous Rikers Island detention facility in New York City is literally on an island in the fast-moving East River between Long Island and the Bronx. It holds a lot of records in the number of youth it detains, its recidivism rate, the number of inmates and mentally ill individuals who are being warehoused there, and the number of people in solitary confinement.
Rikers Island holds 10,000 inmates. I think it's either the largest or the second largest jail in the world. Upwards to about 800 are 21 years and younger. 16 and 17-year-olds are charged as adults. Only New York and North Carolina do that. The environment is just full of all kinds of really crummy vibes.
That's Robert Galinsky, who years ago noted that the United States still leads the industrialized world in its incarceration of young people. And nearly 15 years ago, a visionary New York City teacher sought out ways to provide literacy needs for the rising number of youth across the state. Literacy for Incarcerated Teens was founded. And in 2013, then an activist and artist, Robert Galinsky, decided there was something to be done at Rikers. Galinsky now leads LIT's personal development programs, and it was while working with Rikers' youth population that he met Marla Riera, who was incarcerated at Rikers for 8 months. Marla, Galinsky says, had pretty much lost hope that she could turn her life around until she discovered that reading, being positive, and willing to open up to the world changed everything.
When I hit Rikers, I was like, wow, like this is what my life has come to. This is what I've done to myself. So I was more like a lot of pity to myself, but at the same time, I had to realize, wake up, like, this is, like, your second time here. It has to be your last, you know?
What happened?
Well, I violated probation, and when you violate probation, you have to serve time.
And what was your original offense?
Well, it was a felony, something serious. So that's why I had to serve the time as well.
So two strikes. You said second time here, I'm not doing this again.
So I came out, you know, I did graduate high school. I have my diploma and everything. But I feel like I should have been in college at this point. I'm 20 years old, you know. So when I came home, I'm just focusing, you know, on working and going to school and steering away from being back on that path.
Robert, when young people like Marla decide, I want to change the direction of my life, but they're in Rikers and they seek someone to help them, are they likely to find that help?
Surprisingly, there are a lot of good hearts in Rikers Island trying to help and support people.
And you're one of them.
And I'm one of them.
What's the mission?
The mission is to look inside, see what you really want to offer the world, and get clarity on that. And the advantage that someone like Marla has in Rikers is that all of your distractions are stripped away. You didn't come here because you wanted to, but bottom line is, when you're at Rikers, you don't have your neighbors bothering you. You don't have good influences, bad influences. You don't have TV, radio, internet. You don't have any. Everything's been stripped away, the distractions. So what are you left with? You're left with yourself. So what are you going to do here at Rikers? Are you going to sit with yourself, like Marla says, and be pity? Or look at where you are and say, where can I go from here?
What was your idea of literacy before you ran into Robert?
Well, I went to a journalism high school, so we did a lot of writing. At first, I was like, literacy, what are we going to do, sit and write about people and about how we feel? Like, no, I don't want to do it. But then one of my friends was like, you know, I know this guy, Robert. He's really cool. He brings his candy sometimes. I was like, all right, I'll go downstairs. So we went down, and he started off talking about having a yes mindset, a studio mindset, meaning say yes to everything. And that grabbed my attention, because in a space so full of negative energy and negative vibes and no and all this stuff, to have somebody to come in and tell you there's still a positive path, you can still look up, you can still do this, you can still do that, it's kind of like support. And I felt like, you know, maybe there's really people out there that have faith in me.
You're described as a coach.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, do you think of yourself as a coach, and how do you use literacy? I mean, the traditional idea of literature and writing and reading to get to where Marla is.
For me, I come in and I talk about who we are. I use literacy more as a tool. I don't come in and say, okay, here's a stack of paper and let's learn how to write. I say, what are we working on? Again, going, we call it a studio mindset. If you want to be a chef, you don't have distractions. If you want to be an automobile mechanic in the garage, they put all the distractions aside and they work on their mission. So we talk about what's our mission as a human being, and then the tools that we use are, we read magazines, we read articles, we write letters to editors, we write letters to our family. In that, we then start to make the corrections with grammar and vocabulary and definitions of words. So the philosophy is more about, again, who are you? What do you want to say to the world? How can we accomplish that?
And does this turn prison into some mushy kind of everyone hugging everyone else sort of place?
Sometimes.
Kinda, yeah. Yeah, it does. There's a lot of different personalities in there, a lot of different backgrounds, a lot of different stories. So when you put all that in one room and you're trying to get people to talk about their feelings, and, you know, it can either go one way or the other.
How do you gauge the success of the program? It's not just people feeling positive, right? It's got to be something more tangible than that.
Progress is, yes, I'm not afraid to write, for one thing. So I got people now writing poetry, writing plays, and writing letters to an editor where they didn't want to write before. People learning new definitions of words, words they may have been saying over and over but didn't really know the meaning. Like, vulnerability is one of the words that we keyed in on a lot, that, like, your strength comes from your vulnerability. And everybody was like, no way, not in here, not in here. But after a while of examining that, we really found that, yeah, when you're vulnerable, when you're willing to take a risk, that is where your strength comes from. A lot of these young people have to go in front of a judge or a probation officer, and they have to write reports or letters, and let's express ourselves as cleanly and clearly as possible so that we can get the best results.
And what do you think this program has given you that you're going to take a next step?
The yes mentality stuck with me a lot, because if you have something you want to achieve, and you tell yourself you can't, then obviously you're not going to do it. So having a mentality, a studio mindset with yes, I feel like if you go through life thinking like that, then you, whatever you want is yours.
Hug time.
Yeah, big hug time. Group hug.
Big hug time. All right, Marla Riera, yes. Currently works in retail. Been out of Rikers for how long?
About 2-3 months.
Congratulations. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Robert Galinsky is an author, speaker, and performer who coaches incarcerated youth through a program called Literacy for Incarcerated Teens right here in New York. Robert, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com. And Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
Music don't change the world.
There's something happening here.
Got to fight the powers that be.
We shall overcome.
I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised.
Music don't change the world. Only the audience can change the world. But a good songwriter can offer a different perspective.
From Something's Happening Here to the revolutionary song that became the French national anthem, to the songs of Africa that became the powerful blues hymns that became the songs of the civil rights movement. Politics, like romance, needs poetry and song.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board.
The late Curtis Mayfield certainly understood that. So, people get ready. We are singing the songs of change on The Takeaway for the 2016 summer campaign season. Musicians of different genres, identities, and political outlook who are using their work to take a stand and broadcast their message.
Let's make a milk or green tea.
We begin with 57-year-old Craig R. Moss, a guitar-playing country singer from Oswego, New York, who fancies himself a bit of a Woody Guthrie figure, but not in the way you'd expect. He's driven his pickup truck with a guitar in hand to dozens of Donald Trump rallies across the country, playing songs solely dedicated to the presumptive Republican presidential nominee.
I'm following the Trump campaign as best I can. I'm not in any way affiliated with the campaign. However, they know that I'm here and pretty much allow me to do as I will out there with the crowds that are standing in line for the rallies.
What are the supporters like? Are they very familiar people? Are they different kinds of people, young people, old people, angry people? What do you find?
Very different, very happy. When I play for these folks, I get them all rallied up, and they applaud, they laugh, they want to take pictures. And you have some supporters that aren't afraid to get into a protester's face, and that, unfortunately, is what causes disruption.
You said that very diplomatically there, Craig. And let's hear your Donald Trump for President song.
All right. Driving down this road, singing once again, trying to find my life, trying to make good time. But don't see I'm wondering now each and every day, what's gonna happen and how's it gonna pay? I'm headed on down this road, singing Trump for president. What's gonna happen, Lord, my son, I won't forget. I'm headed on down this road, singing Trump for president. Well now, oh heavenly highway, please don't forget to vote down Trump for president. Well, don't see I'm wandering now each and every day. What's gonna happen? How's it gonna pay? I'm headed on down this road, singing Trump for president. What's gonna happen? My son, I won't forget. Well, now, I'm headed on down this road singing Trump for president. What's gonna happen? Lord, my son, I won't forget. I'm headed on down this road singing Trump for president. Well, now, oh, heavenly highway, please don't forget to vote Donald Trump for president. Donald J. Trump for president.
So, Craig, I love that.
Well, thank you very much.
It seems a little, though, you could have inserted almost anyone's name there in that song, right? You're traveling down the road. It could have been, you know, anyone for president.
Well, I suppose the whole idea here is of traveling down the road, trying to figure out my life, trying to make good time going from one place to another in the car, trying to make that next rally. And, of course, making a reference to my son, I will not forget, who died tragically from a heroin overdose, January 6, 2014. I spoke with Mr. Trump at a rally in Urbandale, Iowa. He came from behind that podium, the front of that stage. He said, first and foremost, I want to tell you I'm sorry for your loss. I simply told him that I'd lost a son to heroin. I wanted to know if he becomes president, what measures he would be taking to combat the ongoing heroin epidemic in this country. And he came and comforted me first, and I thought that was very nice of him. And he calmed me down, because by that time I was crying like a spring rain. And he just said, you know, your son, I'm sure, was a good man, and you're a good father. And we're going to do the very best we can to protect all our borders, to keep heroin and other drugs from coming into this country, and also making treatment facilities easier and more accessible to the kids.
Sounds like the candidate addressed your concern, and we are all here sorry for your loss as well. Craig, I wonder if I could turn you into a traveling campaign reporter for a moment. I mean, since you've been on the road with Trump for so long, what's it like at each one of these rallies?
The supporters always welcome me, and I do my very best to try to play a neutral at times with protesters as well.
What about the candidate? Is he always the same personality? Is he upbeat? Is he downbeat? Is he hoarse sometimes? Does he get a little out of control? Give me a sense. You've seen him in every light.
You know, he always seems to be the same. He never backs down, and that's one of the things that's attractive to myself, actually, and all his supporters, is he holds his ground. But, you know, obviously, you know, he has pulled back and eased up on some of his strong stances and starting to try to negotiate, I suppose, his position on different issues. So,
have you thought of giving him any advice about anything? And did you feel as though he got himself into a pickle on something? And if you'd had the chance, you would have given him a little bit of advice from your perspective out there in the crowd?
If I had my chance and to say one thing, and I say this because I have lived in California for 10 years, I have seen how hard immigrants work, and they work under awful conditions. If I had one advice or one suggestion, it would be towards immigration, and that is when we find immigrants who have been in this country, people from everywhere that have used that southern border to enter the United States and have nestled themselves into the United States working, if they have been here and have maintained a clean record, if you will, I say we give those folks a piece of paper, you fill it out, and within a year, turn them into U.S. citizens and say, thank you, welcome to our country.
You're going to vote for Trump, it sounds like, right?
Oh, obviously. I voted for him in the New York primaries.
Yeah. Yeah. You think he's going to be president?
I'll tell you what. This is the only trouble he might have becoming president, and that would be if Bernie Sanders somehow ends up hooked up with Hillary Clinton. If he would accept a vice president role with Hillary Clinton, I think he could have run for his money, Mr. Trump will. But it'll be interesting in the end.
You've got a song called Trump Train, is that right?
Yes, I do.
Why don't you take us out on that?
All right, sounds good.
Stomping for the Trump man once again. Stomping for the Trump man once again. Jim bound that Trump train, roll on down the line. Trump train keep it rolling on down the line. Trump train keep it rolling on down the line. Jim bound Trump train, roll on down the line. Roll on, Trump train, roll on.
Isn't it a jet, though, Craig?
You got me there, John.
Well, Craig Moss, thanks so much and good luck to you.
Well, thank you, John.
So, hey, folks, you got a little We Shall Overcome singing away in your soul these days? Is the summer of 16 likely to be a summer of protest music, old and new? We are doing a series on all this called People Get Ready, and we suspect you are ready. We will hear in Free Speech America later this hour a song for Donald Trump. But we asked you to write your own very own four-line protest tune, Washington, Pennsylvania. If you give everyone an oil drill, will there be less pollutin'? If you give everyone a big gun, will there be less shootin'?
This is Steve Trimble from Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. Here is my four-line protest song. Don't blame the poor. Don't blame the brown people. Troubles are your own. Don't know how good you got it.
This is Joshua Cohen from Martinez, California. Hillary haters sang their song, said Trump will win, it won't be long. Then came November, the tide overwhelmed. The election was over, they were wrong, wrong, wrong.
Nice. Call us at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway, and you can ask me anything on Twitter. Follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway. Ask me anything and I'll get back to you. If I'm not overwhelmed with more songs, here's another one from a listener who went for some extra credit.
A protest rap song by Randy Sanders of St. Helens, Oregon. Land of the semi-free, home of the rave. Democracy is so bleak, it's impossible to save. Science is mocked. Education's in the dump. Candidates from reality TV, and that's why we have Trump.
USA! USA!
The shining city on a hill is in serious decay.
USA! USA!
We have nothing to fear but America itself. And I'm moving to Norway.
You get your extra credit, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. Learn more at TIAA.org.